court is ready to hear argument in 04-1119 in re Applied Chemical Magnesius Corporation.
May I please report, Mr. David Pierce will present an argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes as well.
May I please report? There are at least four reasons why this contract an issue in this case is subject to the mandatory venue provision under 15.011 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. The first is that it in itself is an agreement to convey land. The document itself states that after a six-month feasibility period, my client ACM has the option to give notice, pay a $5,000 fee, and have leases conveyed covering the mineral rights on the property in question.
But so was the agreement in Smith, wasn't it?
Well, Your Honor, except all of these options, all of the conditions predicate were performed, and so this, an option, is an interest in land. And so properly construed, this document, unlike the document in Smith, would be considered an option agreement rather than simply an unperformed contract for specific performance or an executory contract. Further, Your Honor, the reason this document by itself is a conveyance of real estate subject to the mandatory venue provisions is it contains in paragraph 8 current production royalties. It obligates the payment of royalties which have always been considered to be a conveyance of land, so that if instead of calling this a suit to construe the obligations of the party, but if it were a suit for breach of contract for payment of production royalties, there would be no question but that it was a suit subject to the mandatory venue. So that merely reading this contract by itself proves that it's subject to the mandatory venue provision. There's also a significant line of cases which we've cited which state that a declaratory judgment action, which is in reality an effort to quiet title, is subject to the mandatory venue provisions. Even an unrecorded document, such as a contract, can constitute a cloud on title. My client has filed the Liz Pendens in this case, claiming that this document plus his activities, which I'll describe, give it title to the surface and mineral rights at Marble Canyon in Culberson County.
What's puzzling is the is your counterclaim just sues for damages for breach. And I know you say you can't judge the petition by the counterclaim, and I take your point on that, but it looks like if this were really about land, you'd ask for the land.
Well, Your Honor, that is one of several deficiencies in the record as it exists today, which you could point out with some accuracy. The hearing at the motion to transfer transcript reveals that through some errors between an attorney that was substituting out myself and counsel for the real party in interest, they didn't receive the second amended motion to transfer until 2 days before the hearing, which is a violation of the statute, and rather than continue the hearing, they filed their reply brief 1 day before, which also is not permitted, but given the circumstances, we agreed. So there are a number of deficiencies in the record that had this been properly pleaded and delivered, probably would have been cured. The issue that's really before you now was not really raised by the real party in interest, at least in document form, until the day before, and so there was no way to really squarely present the issues in the pleadings before the court.
Well, let me ask you this. If all anybody wanted was damages, would it fall under the mandatory provision?
Depends on what form. If it was damages...
Well, this agreement, and both sides allege a breach, and each side claims damages.
If the damages is in the form of payment for royalties, then yes, it clearly would be. Every agreement or obligation in this document is about real estate. While it has been described as a declaratory judgment action to construe the rights and obligations of the party, every right and obligation contained in this document concerns either the conveyance of mineral leases, the payment of a royalty, the construction of a mill on the property to be conveyed. I understand that a copy of the letter has been distributed to the court, but what is not attached to that letter but is attached to the original agreement are the property descriptions of the land in Culberson County that is the subject of this agreement. This is a real estate document. There really can be no dispute of that. The third theory that supports the application of 15.011 is equitable title, under which even a contract to convey real estate can confer equitable title if the grantee performs all conditions precedent. The record reflects that there were three things to be performed by my client as a predicate to the receipt of recordable mineral leases. One was a feasibility study. Second was notice to the real party in interest of its intent to go forward with the construction of a mill. And the third is the payment of $5,000, which was negotiated by the real party in interest. At that point, in the sequence of events identified in this document, they were, under the language, shall cause reportable leases of mineral and surface rights in the subject lands appropriate to the project contemplated herein to be delivered to ACMC. So we claim that equitable title has been created by our performance of all conditions precedent. The fourth and perhaps most compelling basis for distinguishing the line of cases.
Just to ask you on the last one. but I take it that even if the agreement deals with an interest in real estate within the meaning of the mandatory venue provision, you'd still have to make some claim involving that interest before the venue provision would operate.
Well, actually, no. That's not correct, Your Honor. In fact, the court will look past the plaintiff's pleadings to the real nature of the controversy, and particularly here where the contract itself was attached to the plaintiff's original petition. The court is obliged to review both the petition and the terms of the contract to determine whether the pleading does or must implicate an interest in land subject to 15.011. Beyond that, while the language of the counterclaim admittedly only alleges damages, although it does state that all conditions predicate to the conveyance of lease have been performed, in the evidence attached to the second amended motion to transfer, there's an affidavit which describes exactly the sequence of events resulting in the refusal to convey the mineral leases. So we believe that all the documents reviewed together by the trial court in the motion to transfer would have revealed an interest in land subject to the mandatory venue provision.
Well, I guess that's my problem. If I can read this agreement and see that surely equitable title could be involved, but if nobody ever says it is, then how can it be under the mandatory venue?
Well, Your Honor, the quote from the judge, and again, admittedly, there are deficiencies in the record and in the pleadings, but the court at the trial hearing phrased the issue this way. I think the issue boils down to whether the controversy is about ownership, either legal or equitable title, or about breach of contract to convey an ownership interest. So while the pleadings may not have raised the issue as artfully as they should have, the court recognized the issue presented in the motion to transfer venue. But the strongest basis for the application of the mandatory venue statute is really the performance that the record demonstrates by the parties under this agreement. Not only has the feasibility study been performed and the results shared as required, the notice to proceed been delivered, the $5,000 been paid and negotiated, and recordable deeds been demanded and refused, but a mine mill site lease has been executed in relation to this agreement, conveying to my client a lease of a portion of the subject lands. And then the record further reflects that my client has been mining on the subject lands since 1999. And so it would truly be an effort to ignore reality to suggest that apart from all that has actually occurred at Marble Canyon in Culberson County and is occurring today, nevertheless, this pleading to construe this agreement does not affect an interest in land subject to the mandatory venue provision. The fifth and final point I wish to make is, on a broader basis, the court could consider whether an action for specific performance, which has not been pleaded by either party, but fits under the terms of 15.011, almost all of the adjudication of the mandatory venue provision has occurred under the predecessor statute, Article 14 of Section 1995 of the Texas Civil Statutes. 15.011 actually broadens, by its language, the application of the earlier statute. It actually affects not only the recovery of land, but it extends it to an interest or a stake in land. And it raises the question, what did the legislature mean when they extended 15.011 to cover an interest or a stake in land? It's always been the law of this state that any interest in land, whether it be a royalty interest, an easement, a lease, even an option, has been an interest in land. And if it were settled law, why would the legislature expand the statute to not only specifically cover the recovery of land or an interest in land? And one possible interpretation is really what they were trying to do was to end this schism where a party could attempt to artfully plead around the mandatory venue by calling it a trespass to try title, they call it a declaratory judgment. Or instead of calling it a suit to quiet title, they call it a declaratory judgment. Or a plaintiff might inadvertently call it a suit for specific performance rather than a suit to enforce an option in land. Or another type of suit which does implicate a constructive trust. I mean, the bullseye of the declaratory judgment that the real party in interest is attempting to hit is getting smaller and smaller, because whether it be through constructive trust or through the equitable title, these different theories are crowding in on this schism that existed going back into the 19th century between the specific performance line of cases, which are not covered by a mandatory venue, and all of the other types of real estate suits that are covered, that it seems reasonable that it would really enhance the efficiency of the court and of the jurisdiction of this state if the court would really say that the 15.011 no longer recognizes that distinction. Whatever policy analysis there is that requires that suits on real estate be heard in the county where the real estate applies certainly applies equally to suits for specific performance as to an easement, an option, or a road. To the extent there is any on-site requirement, it would apply equally.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the real party.
May it please the court, Mr. Sam McDaniel will present argument for the real party in interest.
May it please the court, the position of the relator, to me at least, is based on assumptions. They assume that the letter agreement is a lease and that they know what the terms of that lease are, or perhaps that the terms of the lease are not essential. I don't know either one of those things. And one reason that I have had a copy of the letter placed on the bench in front of you is because I thought it might be helpful both from a standpoint of review of the letter, but also from the standpoint of tracing the sequence of events here. The letter starts out saying this proposal, when accepted by you in the manner provided below, will constitute a letter of agreement. Well, what does that mean? They apparently take the position that they may grab one provision out of it down there when they get to it and say that it means when we paid the $5,000, you have accepted it and you take the $5,000 and deposit it. You've accepted it and you're obligated to make leases. Still doesn't furnish us any terms for the leases at that point. To me, the furnishing of the leases themselves, negotiating out the terms of the lease, would be the more probable acceptance. And the letter is set up so that it says, upon receipt of such recordable documents, ACMC shall have 6 months within which to construct the facility. That's also referred to in the letter conveying the $10,000. I mean the $5,000, I'm sorry. The problem in this case is that when it came down to time to negotiate the terms of the lease, the parties were unable to negotiate terms of the lease. And this letter does not tell us when the lease starts or when it ends or very much about it at all. It doesn't even tell us what the lease is supposed to cover. Now, it's true that there is attached to the letter the description of 554 acres of land. The only lease that they ever agreed on, which was for the mill site, is a lease that covers 20 acres out of that.
So you think if the terms were more definite, it would come under the mandatory venue provision?
No, I don't think it would, because we didn't bring the suit for that. But I wanted to address the deficiencies here in this as an instrument.
What did you want to happen as a result of the suit?
I wanted the court to tell us what this letter does and whether or not it is an agreement that's creates enforceable rights. I don't think it does. So, but that's my opinion.
If you don't think it does, then, in fact, you want them off the land.
No, I haven't asked for them to get off the land. They've taken the position, this is the lease.
right?
And we've got rights. And I say, what are they?
But normally, you know, there's two theories of filing lawsuits. One is plaintiff files a suit saying I've got a claim and the defendant's got to tell them whether they have one or not. The other claim is that we ask the plaintiff first, since they started the thing, what is it you want? And it is extraordinarily vague to say, I want you to tell me what I've got, if anything. Now, the problem is, of course, if they're going to file mandatory venue and venue objections, motion transfer, they got to do it at the start. And so they certainly, we don't want the law to be such a situation where people do artfully plead things because they don't really want to try the case where the land is. You'd agree with that much, at least. We don't want people making deliberately vague initial petitions, and then it turns out in the Seventh Amendment petition they won't title the land, but it's too late.
I don't, you know, that's the law, as I understand it. I don't have a particular desire one way or another, and I think I'm being accused of considerably more guile than I possess.
That may be. But we're asking you now, what were you suing for? And you're telling me I'm suing for whatever I have a right to. But
well, people
don't file a suit just because they're curious.
They file
a suit because they think they ain't getting something, and I want to know what
that is. That's not entirely true, and that's not true in this case, and that's not what the Declaratory Judgment Act contemplates. This is a, to me, classic suit for a declaratory judgment. Let me go on through the letter for a minute and show you some things here. Some of them will take evidence.
But to follow up on that question, when you say, Judge, please tell us what this means, the judge is going to say, well, what do you think it means? And then what are you going to say?
I'm going to say we're going to put on expert witnesses to testify about what it means.
Well, what, and that is that?
Well, you've got the question, first of all, which I've already addressed, is what does acceptance as provided below, what does that reference, what does it trigger? Then you've got a question. They have said that they're going to build a separation milling facility that will beneficiate, that's in the first numbered paragraph, and there's an I left out of the word down there. After the C, there should be another I. Because one of the things that caused the problem here is they went ahead and jumped the gun and built a mill out there without having these leases and things in place. We went ahead for 2 years trying to negotiate the arrangement between the parties.
Well, but you could watch them building that, surely.
Sure, we watched them building it. But the problem was they built something that's not what they represented. That's what disturbed my client. What they built is not a separation facility. It's not something that will beneficiate this ore, and it's not something that will produce a high-purity magnesium hydroxide powder. All of those are things that would be proved up by the evidence.
So what you want them to do is build a different kind of plant.
I don't want them to do anything right now. I want to find out what rights they have under this document.
See, but that's the point. Let's assume they built the wrong kind of plant. If you want them to build the right kind of plant, then I would agree with you. It doesn't look like a suit for title. If you want to kick them off because they built the wrong plant and it's too late to do something else, then it does look title. But only you can tell us, and you won't. What do we do now?
I don't know. Well, let me tell you where we are. Where we are is here. The other side says, I've got a lease. Well, they don't have a lease, as I read this document. And they won't negotiate further from that point. So at that point, we need some definition. What rights exist under this 1999 agreement? That's what I want the court to tell us.
So then, okay. So if the question in the case is, do they have a lease or not? That would come under the mandatory venue.
I don't think so.
Why not?
Because I'm not trying to throw them off. I'm not doing any of the five things that are provided in 15.001.
Well, if they have a lease or they don't have a lease, you're not trying to decide title?
If the court says they've got a lease or you owe them a lease on these terms, we'd probably execute the lease. That's not the problem. The problem is we don't know what to do. The statute says actions for, one, the recovery of real property. We're not trying to do that. Two, for petition of real property. We're certainly not trying to do that. The removal of encumbrances. They say we're trying to do that, but we're not.
So what's going to happen at trial? You're going to go up. The judge says, call your first witness, and you hand the judge the agreement and say, judge, tell us what this means. The judge says again, call your first witness. What case are you going to present? The judge, I'm confused.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I'm going to, the thing that I am going to ask the judge about is whether or not this document specifies the terms that you need in a lease, and whether or not it's enforceable from that standpoint. Past that point, and this is a two-level thing, past that point, I intend to put on expert testimony that what they're doing out there is not beneficiation of this ore, and it's not producing a high-purity magnesium hydroxide powder, and therefore they're not doing what they agreed to do in the instrument. Now, this is not a self-executing thing. It's going to take the presentation of evidence, and it's going to take some decisions by a fact finder as to what's going on out there, because the other side's probably going to say, yeah, this is beneficiation, and we're going to have to prove up what is beneficiation in the mineral industry, and are they doing it, and is this high purity? Would this qualify as high purity? Because what we've got a product out there that my client uses for one thing.
And if you win all of those, you win on everything. It's not beneficiation. It is required beneficiation. Now what happens?
Then, and only then, after we know what this document tells us, we may or may not bring an action to try to dispossess them of premises. Let me give you an example.
So you hadn't decided whether this is a suit for title yet.
We have not pled it as a suit for title.
I know that.
We're trying to find out what it means.
The reason you didn't plead it as that was not to be clever. The reason is because you don't know.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct. And their argument that, well, they've been there producing and that makes a difference, I'd use this example. Let's suppose that I have a place like I used to live on down by the river. It has a bunch of gravel on it. And somebody comes to me and says, I want to make a deal with you to produce that gravel down there. And I hem and haw around and I say, okay, well, let's try to work out a lease. And we get hung up on working out a lease. And he says, well, I want to come in there and produce the gravel. Let me put a plant down there and I'll pay you so much for every ton of gravel that I take out of there. And I say, fine, there's nothing wrong with that deal. There's nothing wrong with us doing that until we work out a long-term lease, if we work out a long-term lease. That's exactly what we've got here. This, to me, is a letter of intent. And the payment of the $5,000 was simply a payment equivalent to earnest money to say, okay, it's now time to go to the next step. Let's go in here and let's sit down and let's really get into serious negotiations. And serious negotiations are what's called for here, because this is not an oil and gas lease. And that's not to say that an oil and gas lease is necessarily a simple document. You've got to have terms in them. But this is a mining lease where they're using explosives and working underground out there. And there's two of them in there. And they're big issues as far as control of the mine and the mining plan and shooting explosives off in it and things like that that have got to be addressed.
Mr. McDaniel, ACM obviously thinks that it owns something because they're out there doing this, right? And they think this agreement provides them with something, a right to possession of the property to produce whatever they're producing, right or wrong?
Yes, I think they do think
and,
that.
And your declaratory judgment action attempts to throw some doubt as to their right to do what they're doing, wouldn't you say?
My declaratory judgment action attempts to find out, A, whether this is a complete enough document to be an enforceable contract, and B, what the terms of it are.
Well, I know you've said that, but I'm asking you, doesn't your deck action throw some doubt, attempt to throw some doubt over their right to do what they're doing?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Because if it does, then that would seem to be a...
Well, they've taken the position that this is a lease, and we're entitled to go on under. All I'm saying is, I don't think it's a lease. I question whether it is an enforceable instrument, an enforceable contract. But whatever it is, let's define it. Let's define it so we know what we're dealing with. And that's what I understand a declaratory judgment action is for. The mere fact that it has something to do with real estate doesn't make it a mandatory venue case.
So the final result of the declaratory judgment action either could or could not ultimately decide the underlying dispute.
It might provide a basis for deciding the underlying dispute. Let me illustrate what I'm talking about, Justice Green. They argue, this is on page 12 of their petition, given that ACMC currently has possession of the minerals on a portion of the surface and has made improvements to the surface, and let me say there, they do not have exclusive possession of the minerals. That's one of the things here, because the letter recognizes joint rights for both of them to mine out there. Any declaration of the right status and legal relations under the agreement as requested by TAA necessarily will determine whether TAA has the right to exclude ACMC from possession of the land in question. Maybe that's so, but this is not a suit to exclude ACMC. It is not a suit to recover the possession of the land. It's to find out what kind of deal these people made between themselves. Insofar as getting it defined, it's no different, at least in my judgment, than a contract to convey land. You can have a question as to whether or not this contract to convey land is an enforceable contract, but that does not make this a suit to recover land. And in fact, in that case, you could get the contract defined, and you would have to bring a suit for specific performance to try to enforce it. And that clearly, under the case law for over 100 years in Texas, does not come under the mandatory venue provision. So we're walking some close lines here, and I recognize that.
And of course, the difficult thing in venue is, if you start off with a case that's not about land, but it ends up about land, when it goes up on appeal, it's automatically reversible because we don't consider what the trial judge knew at the start. We consider the whole record as it subsequently developed. So if it turns into a land case later, we've wasted all of our time. So shouldn't that suggest at the start, if that's what it might be, that to avoid the problem of wasting an entire trial and appeal, we deem it to be, or at least where it's a close question?
Justice Brister, with greatest respect, I do not agree with your premise. And the reason I don't agree with your premise is we're supposed to be able to look at this thing on the basis of the pleadings at the beginning and determine the venue issues. It's not what it might become on down the way.
But on appeal, that's not what we look at. At the end of the trial, if you win on what we've got on the pleadings, it's not for land, we go to trial, but at trial you ask for the land back and kick them off. Then 15064 says, on appeal, if venue was improper, it shall in no event be harmless error. In determining whether venue was or was not proper, the appellate court shall consider the entire record, including the trial on the merits.
Well, all I can say about that is that's not the lawsuit we brought. Contrary to one of the statements from the bench a while ago, our present lawsuit does not even ask for damages to the real estate. All we ask for is to know what we're dealing with.
Let me ask a question on another matter, just briefly. Paragraph paragraph 10 says this agreement shall be performable in Culberson County. What was the purpose of that, you think?
I don't know. Let me say that neither I nor opposing counsel had anything to do with this document.
I take it that you don't think it has any effect on the venue.
I don't think so. There is one other thing. We've kind of gotten a feel a little bit from the progression that I was going to have, but it says this agreement shall not be assignable. However, the mineral leases contemplated here under may be assigned. That's in the 11th provision. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Your Honors, I would just point out a couple of things. This letter was accepted in the manner provided below because the manner provided below is found on the last page above the signatures where it states that if the foregoing properly and accurately reflects your understanding of the agreement, please indicate approval and acceptance by executing in the space provided below. It didn't depend on any other action or any other payment in the body of the agreement. Once the party signed, as they did sign, and note that they initialed each page, as is typical with what the parties consider a binding contract. And in fact, they agreed that it was a binding contract in paragraph 11, just before the assignment language that you were just referred to. It states this is a binding document. It is not simply an invitation to negotiate, as paragraph 4 states. Once my client gave notice of its intent to construct the separation milling facility, from that date, 12 months from that date, it incurred the obligation to pay $200,000 in royalties. That does not imply some effort to open a negotiation. That's a firm, fixed obligation in real estate for the payment of royalty.
So, flip side of the question I was asking opposing counsel. If we grant mandamus transfer to Culberson County, the trial judge determines, declares that their version of understanding the contract is right, and simply orders your client to build a different kind of plant or whatever it is it turns out at that point they want, then aren't we again going to have to reverse, because on the whole view of the record, if venue transfer was improper, it's improper forever, it's automatic reversible error, and it turns out this was not really a case about title to land.
If that were the facts, none of those facts are reflected in the record. Their petition doesn't say they built the wrong kind of facility. And so as to whether that's what is reflected by the record is their statement that ACMC, this is the one moderately concrete statement in the petition, ACMC contends that TAA is obligated by the April 1999 letter to do certain things, and TAA does not agree. And then in our second amended motion to transfer, we state TAA has failed and refused to deliver the leases contemplated by the letter agreement. So the one specific event or non-event that is raised by the pleadings is the non-conveyance of leases. If they felt that we built the wrong facility or that we didn't have right to be on the land, there is a much more simple and direct, a forcible entry and detainer suit, or, but this type of document certainly does not arise from a disagreement as to whether we're building the right type of facility on the the land, filed 4.5 years after the execution of this document and the initiation of the mining of minerals on the land. The one point I do wish to make about if this document were in a vacuum, it does not contain certain terms that would be appropriate for a lease, but of course in the statute of frauds, part performance can constitute an exception, custom in the industry possibly, and so now here we are 6 years later into the parties have had some commercial relationship. Certainly a jury could supply if there were missing terms based on the practice of the parties. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes all the arguments for today, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.